Okay, welcome everybody. I'm speaking on behalf of the ZOA, Zionist Organization of America. We work for Strong, Secure Israel. I have some literature on the table. If you want to join ZOA, there's a form there. And one of our friends put some other literature out of this table. Let's see. I do want to get started right away because it's getting a little late. We have tonight a very special guest, David Yerushalmi, Esquire. He is a trial lawyer specializing in national security and public policy law. He received his Juris Doctorate degree from the Sandra Day O'Connor College of Law at Arizona State University in 1984. He's an expert on Sharia, that is Islamic law, and the Jihad movement. He has worked with Frank Gaffney's Center for Security Policy, for which he has co-authored several studies on Sharia and Jihad. He is co-founder and senior counsel of the American Freedom Law Center, a national public interest law firm dedicated to fighting for limited government, federalism, and America's Judeo-Christian heritage. He has also drafted an act called the American Laws for American Courts Act to help insulate state courts from the growing tendency to embrace constitutionally offensive foreign laws such as Sharia. So I would like to introduce to you David Yerushalmi.
I don't know that I need a microphone, but I will use it because I know that Howard wanted to get an audio recording. And we were going to have a PowerPoint projector, but apparently it's not working tonight. So I'm going to look at my PowerPoint and try to explain it to you. The truth is, in a group like this, and in an event like this, I don't think PowerPoints are really useful. This talk, which we've entitled Sharia as the Force Behind Global Anti-Israel Movement, is not going to be a high-altitude fluff discussion. What I mean by that is oftentimes when you have a one-night, a one-off event, you can only cover so much material. But because this is a rather dedicated audience that's coming to a ZOA event, I'm operating under the assumption that you want more than a high-level discussion. So we're going to get down into the weeds, as they say, and get into some detail. It is, on the other hand, not going to be a seminar-type lecture that's going to overload you because you only have one night. What I'm hoping is going to be the effect of this evening's talk is that you're going to hear some facts from me and some opinions, and that if those are provocative to you in one way or the other, you will delve yourself into those materials that are available. They're available on our website, which I'll provide the information. They're available on the Center for Security Policy's website, Frank Gaffney's organization, of which I'm general counsel as a disclosure. And that's really the purpose of this evening. I assume that many of you will know much of what I'm going to say, maybe not in the detail or the particulars. And some of you might even have a visceral reaction that says, yeah, I get that. I will tell you this discussion tonight is a lot easier than it was circa 2003, 2004, 5, 6, 7, 8. And the reason being is because today people are more likely to recognize the threat from Sharia, Islamic law, than they did after the beginning days of the Iraq War and post 9/11. Because you'll all remember in those days we were being told whatever's taking place in Afghanistan, whatever's being brought to our shores in 9/11, whatever took place on the USS Cole, whatever's happening in South America at US embassies, none of that has anything to do with Islam. that has to do with the corruption of Islam, the extremist kidnapping of Islam. Or we heard in the context of the so-called Israeli-Palestinian dispute that it has nothing to do with Islam. It's about geopolitics. It's about the fact that Israelis and Jews have sovereignty, and the Palestinians want their sovereignty. And the terrorism that arises from that dispute has nothing to do with religion. I'm here to tell you that both of those narratives are demonstrably false. Now, what I'm going to do is present, if I can get this working on the... What I'm going to do is present three theses to you tonight. The first two are based upon fact and logic, which I would argue with anyone is not refutable. You might not like the results of those theses, but they are, in effect, demonstrated by history and by current events. The third thesis that I'm going to present to you tonight is my opinion based upon my expertise in national security and national security-related legal issues. After this talk, which will range around 40, 45 minutes, we'll have an open Q&A, and we can get into it even greater detail. So the three theses that I'm presenting to you, and I'm just going to read them as I've written them. Number one, global Israeli hatred, and I mean by that what we see in the BDS movement, UN resolutions, ad nauseam, which is not a new phenomenon, but one that continues to grow, is really about hatred of Judaism and Jews and less about Israel. Two, Sharia, or Islamic law, and not simply culture or geopolitical issues, is the source of the hatred of Jews and Judaism. Three, progressives and Islamist Muslim Brotherhood types ally with one another over hatred of all things Western and Judeo-Christian, and on social welfare, hatred of capitalism. Those are the three theses, the third one being one where I've used my judgment and expertise to arrive at that understanding. Let's go back now to number one. This is rather easy to demonstrate, that global Israel hatred, which is not a new phenomenon, but one that continues to grow, is really about hatred of Judaism and Jews and less about Israel. So what does that mean? Oftentimes, in fact, throughout Jewish history, it's been fairly easy to identify the source of Jew hatred and violence against Jews. It was either from governments, whether they be the Tsar's governments, European governments, that came from a Christian world that persecuted Jews. That migrated into the 20th century, where everyone understood that Jew hatred was a product of fascism, the Nazis, Yimach Shemam, and all of the variations of that. Now, we know the Jew hatred from the white, Aryan, neo-Nazi types continues to exist. We felt it right here in San Diego and elsewhere. That's not going to ever go away. But I would argue that it's not the real dangerous form of Jew hatred, because it typically is directed at individuals or individual places of worship, and it's isolated. As tragic and as awful as any loss of life or damage is, the fact is that as an existential threat to Jews, it no longer operates at the level it did when it was state-controlled in Europe. Today, Our position is that the global hatred of Israel represents the new form of Jew hatred. And you can demonstrate that in two fashions. One, look at the UN resolutions that condemn Israel. And this is an argument that many have made over the years. It's impossible to make the position or to take the position that Israel represents the single greatest threat to what we will put in quotation marks, human rights. Yet, the UN attacks Israel for human rights violations more often than any other country or any other example combined in the world. You also cannot look at the way Israel treats Palestinians, even according to their narratives, and draw in any kind of line that connects to the resolutions that condemn Israel time and time again. So if it isn't related to Israel's conduct, what is it related to? If you look at the BDS movement and you examine how successful it is in capturing the minds, especially of Europeans and of Hollywood types and of campuses across this country and countries in Europe, in the Far East, and you look at what they claim is their argument about Israel's treatment of Palestinians, you're left to ask, well, what about the Tibetans? What about the Chechens in Russia, the Muslims in Russia? What about the Kurds? What about the Uyghurs, the Muslim community in China, which is being devastated by the communist government? Because there's no correlation between the global Israel hatred and what Israel actually, how Israel actually conducts itself, there can't be any rational or coherent argument that Israel hatred is related to Israel. And it can't be related to the plight of the Palestinians, because all of these groups I've mentioned suffer far more than the Palestinians, according to their narrative, have suffered over time. So something else has to be at work. And what is that something else? Well, I can tell you that after 9/11, and I've been in the national security field for all of my professional career, now 36 years, and I will concede that through the 90s, when my wife and I were living in Israel and we were working on various international projects with and without the Israeli government, I remember sitting with Turks, and this was before Erdogan and the Islamists took over. This was when the Turkish government was very pro-Israel, Kemalist, the progeny from Ataturk. And I remember them saying, you people have got it wrong, meaning we Israelis who were there. You think that the terrorism emanating from the Palestinians has something to do with politics and geopolitics, about land and sovereignty, when in reality it has to do with Islam and Islamic law. And we would look at them and say, come on, don't be silly. We know exactly what the Palestinians are doing and why they're doing it. And it's about land, it's about real estate and politics. As it turned out, as the USS Cole was bombed, as embassies were bombed, that didn't connect to the Palestinian, so-called Palestinian-Israeli dispute, I and others in the national security arena, especially in Israel, kept our eyes closed. In fact, the Israeli government was the first to sponsor Hamas, thinking that they would be like the Haredi, they would be like the black hat Jews, peaceful, docile, and will generate leadership from the religious Muslim community to overtake what they saw as a secular terrorist PLO. Well, we all know how that turned out. The Turks were right, and they were so right they didn't understand the threat in their own backyard from men like Erdogan and the other Islamists. And now they're gone. The secular Turks are gone. After 9/11, those of us in the national security field, at least some of us, looked around and said, something's not right with the narrative that we've been living with for two decades. And I was as guilty as the next. I spent from 9/11, literally the day after, I was in Israel at the time, studying Islamic law and understanding what the common, what we call in our parlance, the common threat doctrine was. Because when you looked at the political tracks and statements of Al-Qaeda, and those were the first that we studied, and then you looked at the other terrorist organizations around the globe, the Islamic terrorist organizations, whether they be Palestinian, Saudi, Pakistani, Chinese, Russian, Filipino, it didn't matter where, Iran, they all spoke about Sharia as their guiding force. And they explained in clear terms that Sharia demands a global caliphate run by Islamic law. And there are three ways, according to Sharia, that you establish a global caliphate. The first is dawah, what we might call in Hebrew kiruv. It's proselytization. It's reaching out and trying to convince the kufr to embrace Islam. If that doesn't work, and you're not a believer in idols, but people of the book, and they've expanded that definition beyond Jews and Christians, then you can live as a subjugated people called Al-Adim, which has been anglicized into Dimitu. And what is a subjected Dimi subject to? He has no sovereignty in the Muslim country in which he lives. He can't worship his religion publicly. He pays a special jizya tax. And he is subject to the caliph's attacks at any moment. Because under Sharia, the caliph, the leader of the sovereign, the Muslim sovereign, can use attacks on Jews or any dhimmi as an abject lesson to the rest of the citizenry. So that's number two. Either you're persuaded or you're subjugated. What if you choose neither to be persuaded nor to be subjugated? Well, according to Islam, where you will find quoted by every Islamist when he's trying to create an apologia for Islam, there's a verse in the Quran that says, there is no coercion in Islam. And I would say they're absolutely correct. Because if you choose not to be persuaded through dawah, if you choose not to be subjugated as a dhimmi, then you've chosen death by jihad. It's your choice. That's Islamic legal doctrine. That's what we learned when we examined all of the various Islamic terrorist groups around the globe. By the way, most of whom did not speak with one another because they didn't all understand Arabic, spoken Arabic. They had different political arguments and narratives going on in their own countries, most of whom probably would be hard-pressed to even point out where the Palestinians are supposed to be living on a map, but they understood Sharia. So when we looked at Sharia and understood that it is a sophisticated legal system and it has been institutionalized in Islam as, in fact, the only institution in Islam for 1,500 years. When you understood that, what you had to first capture was whether or not President George Bush was correct when he stood up on the podium and said, announced the Bush Doctrine. The Bush Doctrine was Islam has nothing to do with what took place at 9/11. And if we go into Iraq and we liberate those Muslim Iraqis, and we let them dip their fingers in that blue ink or green ink, whatever color it was. I think it was purple ink, if I'm not mistaken. And they vote. They will act according to human nature. Human nature, according to George Bush, and many in the nation-building narrative, says that if you give anyone freedom, that individual will choose liberty and prosperity, democracy, and free markets. Well, we saw the Arab Spring, and we saw what happened. In fact, if you look at world opinion polls, what you see year after year is that in the Muslim world, where 95 to 98% of the Muslims live, and there are 1.6 billion of them, 50 to 80% of the Muslim populations around the Muslim world embrace and want Sharia and a global caliphate. And they agree with the notion under Sharia law that if you're an apostate, meaning you're a Muslim and you reject Islam, you should be subject to the death penalty, which is the law in Pakistan, Saudi Arabia, Iran. If you blaspheme the prophet, and I'm using their terminology here, you're also subject to the death penalty, which is the law in Pakistan, Saudi Arabia, Iran, Jordan, Indonesia, the so-called modern Islamic state. Having gained that context, we now realize that we know what Sharia is. We know it's the common threat doctrine that ties all of these Islamic terrorist groups together. And we now know that it's not a corruption of Islam. It's extant, authoritative Islam. Now, does that mean that there aren't 20, 30, 40, 50% of populations in the Muslim world that reject Sharia? Of course it does. But think about the numbers. If only 50%, and that's the lowest number in any Muslim country, and that happens to be in Indonesia, if just, which is the largest Muslim country in the world with 180 million Muslims, if just 50% of 1.6 billion Muslims in the world embrace Sharia and the global caliphate and the three mechanisms to achieve that, which ends in jihad, you can imagine how dangerous that is. Once we understood that Islam as an institution driven by Islamic law is the common threat doctrine that drives the global jihad, we then wanted to understand, well, what does that tell us about the U.S. and the threat that we might have within our own borders? So we conducted a study. Took approximately four and a half years, more than $500,000, from 2004 to 2008. We sent covert operatives trained in Urdu, Arabic, English, Farsi, in all of the language, and we selected 100 random mosques across the United States that were representative of all the mosques, statistically speaking. And we wanted to measure two variables. The control variable was how religious was this institution. And we had measurements for that. Did they separate the women and the men? when they had their prayer lines, how rigid and how strict were they? What was their facial hair like on the men? What was the clothing on the women? These are legal requirements under Sharia that we could literally measure. And then we studied the variable that we thought might be correlated, which was how much violent jihadist literature and speakers do these mosques promulgate. It so happens that out of all of the mosques representing across the United States, 80% of the mosques were Sharia adherent. 20% were not. Now, I happen to come at the study thinking it wouldn't be that way. It would look maybe that you had 20%, 30% Orthodox, to use that term, and then you'd have kind of the conservative in the middle, and then you'd have the reform on the end, coming from my world. Well, it turns out there was just the 80% that were strictly Sharia adherent, and then the 20% that were just kind of humanistic. When you looked at the 80%, it was a one-to-one correlation with violence. If you remember the terrorist from Yemen that was ultimately killed by a drone, who had been running around the United States kind of helping the 9/11 terrorists, he actually visited several of the mosques while we were undercover and filming. The study, you can find, was called Mapping Sharia. It was published by two peer-reviewed journals. The most distinguished of them was Perspectives on Terrorism, and you can find it online, in which we discussed Sharia, the Pew studies that I mentioned, and the results of the study. What we learned from this study was that in the United States, Sharia as an institution is strong. Now keep in mind that not all Muslims attend mosque. In fact, I dare say in the United States, most Muslims do not, except certain occasions like Ramadan, and probably not even throughout Ramadan. But there's a unique aspect about Islam that you don't find in Western religions. Islam never underwent an enlightenment. Islam never had a reformation. The enlightenment is what led to conservative reform Judaism and Judaism. So if you look at Judaism across the United States, notwithstanding the fact that I'm Orthodox, I would be foolhardy to say that conservative and reform Judaism aren't institutional forms of Judaism. They have their own universities, their own rabbinical ordination, their own conversion. One might argue there are different religions, all three of them, but that's a different discussion. But they're institutionalized in this country. The Reformation for the Catholic Church created all of the Protestant movements, so that you don't have one voice, institutional voice, for what Christianity is. You have the Catholic Church, you have this church, you have that church. Islam never experienced that. Islam has one institutional voice, and that is Sharia. It has universities, Al-Azhar University in Cairo, which is the Harvard of Sunni legal analysis. You do not have reformed or moderate institutional mosque or organizations in the United States or anywhere else in the world. Which is why those 20% mosques tend to go in and out of business very quickly. Or they get taken over by Sharia-adherent Muslims. And I have several stories I could tell, but just know that when someone asks me, well, what about moderate Islam or moderate Muslims? My answer to them is, I'm not speaking about Muslims at all right now. Because a Muslim can be anywhere from an Al-Qaeda enthusiast to a Zuhdi Jasser, who was a patriot and speaks about publicly the threat from Sharia day in and day out, and has put his life and his family's life at risk. You have any number of views about what Islam is. But if you look at the institutional articulation of what Islam is, it's singular. There is a monopoly on what it is. Now, you can talk about the dispute between the Sunnis and the Shias, and that's fine. You can even talk about the dispute between the Sunni Madhhab, the Sunni schools of law, of which there are four or five, depending on how you count them. But they all agree, Sunni, Shia, every legal school of thought in Islam agrees there's one telos, one purpose, one tachlis, as we say in Hebrew, for Islam, a global caliphate run according to Sharia. They all agree univocally that there's three ways to achieve that: dawah, dimitude, or jihad. Those are not disputed. In fact, you can pick up any academic book which attempts an apologia of Islam, and they will somewhere in that book concede those two fundamental points: the purpose of Islam and the methods to achieve it. They will then talk about, well, but there are reformists and there's other ways to interpret Sharia, all well and good, but none of them have become institutionalized. That's Sharia. Sharia demands a global caliphate run according to Shia, and according to Islamic law, Jews and Judaism represent a threat to that institution, to that purpose, and to those methods. It's why they have narratives in sacred text. Many of you have probably heard these, that talk about the end of times when the trees will say, "There's a Jew behind me, come kill him." Or when they say, "Don't take Jews or Christians as your friends. Take them as your enemy." The articulations under Islamic law are plentiful. Now, what we're not doing is looking at specific surah of the Quran. If you fall into that trap where you read a particular verse of the Quran and you pick it out and it seems hostile to Jews or to Western culture, I can find you just as many that seem almost placid and peaceful and Western-like. In the same way, I can pick apart scripture from the Torah, I can pick apart scripture from the Christian world. Scripture itself is meaningless without authoritative commentary about what it means, and beyond that, without the legal jurisprudence to understand what it means as a matter of praxis, meaning how you live your life. So if you're an Orthodox Jew, to make a distinction between good and evil, the sacred and the profane, if you're an Orthodox Jew, and you live your life according to Torah law, it doesn't much matter what it says in the Torah about Shabbos or any matter about Kashrut. What matters is how the rabbis have interpreted that according to Talmudic jurisprudence and the poskim, the legal decisors after the Talmudic jurisprudence, to today, how they interpret those biblical verses. And it is complex. As someone who spent his life studying the Talmud, it is very complex. Sharia is the same. Again, to make a distinction between the good and evil and the holy and the profane, Sharia takes the text of the Quran and on top of that has an oral tradition. Those of you who understand the history of the Mishnah and the Talmud will hear something that clicks. On top of the Quran is this oral tradition that was memorialized into six canonical sunnah. Six. Oral tradition memorialized in a writing on the law into six books. I look to the rabbi because he knows there are six sedras on the Mishnah. And again, to make a distinction between good and evil and the holy and the profane. On top of the Sunnah, the oral tradition that was around during the time of Muhammad's life, that was then canonized, but that's a strange word to use for Islamic legal texts. On top of that are hundreds of years of jurisprudential analysis by legal scholars in Islam. And that resulted in several codifications, the most widely read and followed, especially in the Sunni world, is a book that you might know by the name Reliance of the Traveler, in which it lays out extant Islamic law, which, by the way, has a, what we would call in Hebrew, haskama, it has a imprimatur by Al-Azhar University as being valid, extant, meaning current, Islamic law. And guess what you find in the Book of War? The purpose of Islam is a global caliphate, and there's three methods to get there. And anyone who blasphemes the Prophet or Islam or Sharia is subject to the death penalty. And anyone who leaves Islam as an apostate is similarly subject to the death penalty. Once you've understood the institutional aspect of Sharia and the requirement that they control the world and apply Sharia law to the entire world, not coexistently, but as a supremacist institution, and you recognize how they consider Jews in Israel, then you understand that, at least in the Muslim world, the hatred of Israel is driven by the hatred focused in Sharia. One little more aspect of Sharia law and Israel. The world, according to Islam, is called Dar al-Islam. Dar is Arabic for the realm. In Hebrew, we would use the term ladur, a dirat. It's similar. Dar al-Islam means the realm of Islam, but properly translated, it's the realm of subjugation. That part of the world where Islam has subjugated and has taken over as the sovereign. Once a region has been conquered by Islam, no matter what happens afterward, according to Sharia, it remains part of Dar al-Islam. And according to Sharia, no non-Islamic state can have sovereignty there. Well, if you understand that, you already know that Islam will never make peace with Israel, because Israel is in the heart of Dar al-Islam. The rest of the world is called Dar al-Harab, the realm of war. Because under Sharia, they have to expand Dar al-Islam to the rest of the world. And if they're not willing to go peacefully or to be subjugated, then it becomes jihad and a realm of war. And that's the rest of the world, outside of what was the Islamic Empire. Having now gone through, at least, I think, the first two theses, that Israel hatred is driven, at least in the Muslim world, by Sharia as the common threat doctrine, and understanding Sharia and how it is from its legal perspective and its institutional perspective represents a real existential threat. I now want to jump to that third thesis, which is less demonstrable factually and logically, but one more based upon expertise and experience. The question is always asked of me, we understand why the Muslim Brotherhood organizations, the Council on American Islamic Relations, the Muslim Students Association, the Islamic Society of North America, we understand why the Muslim Brotherhood organizations across the United States, which were founded by Hamas, why they hate Western society, and why they're engaged in what they term stealth jihad, to destroy Western civilization from within, to use our laws, our courts, our legal system to gain a foothold in Western civilization to destroy it. In the PowerPoint, we have evidence from one of the federal terrorist trials where Muslim Brotherhood documents lay that out expressly. But I'm asked, what we don't get is why the leftist organizations, the progressive organizations, the ACLU, the Southern Poverty Law Center, the Democrats, at least part of the Democratic caucuses, why are they so hostile to Israel? Why do they seemingly always embrace the Palestinian narrative and don't examine the reality on the ground in the Middle East? Why is Israel the central focus of their complaints? The answer I will suggest tonight is precisely their aligned purposes. The Muslim Brotherhood and any Islamist has one overarching purpose: to establish a global caliphate that destroys Western civilization as we know it. And that's from their doctrine. The leftist progressive groups have the same purposes. They tell us that they want a global one world state. They want to eliminate borders. And I'm not taking a political position here. I'm simply articulating their positions. And we've seen it in Europe when they've literally eliminated national boundaries and borders in effect throughout the EU. If you look at what's that young group of women who now kind of taken over the Democratic Party? They call them the
squad.
They call them the group or the squad.
The squad.
Look at their agenda. Sharia rejects capitalism. Sharia rejects free markets. Sharia requires a state-controlled allocation of social goods. Within that, there's free markets, of course. But at the top level, no one is allowed to accumulate wealth through capitalistic efforts to the harm of the society at large. And if you look at Sharia-compliant finance, it reads like a leftist socialist tract. And on that note, the leftists and the progressives can embrace with the Muslim Brotherhood in America. If you look at, for example, the Council on American Islamic Relations, the strongest, most well-financed of the Muslim Brotherhood groups, you will see an absolute connection between their rhetoric about socialism and social justice with the far left. What is always odd about this marriage of seemingly strange bedfellows is that in every country that institutes Sharia, the leftist types are the first to get burnt. But they don't recognize that because all the left hears from the Council on American Islamic Relations and other groups is social justice and the destruction of Western imperialism. And on that they unite. Beyond that unification in theory, there is an absolute unification in what is the next section of this talk, lawfare. Lawfare is the use of the courts to achieve political ends. Now, it's been going on since the turn of the 20th century and the establishment of the ACLU. The left got it quickly and got it very efficiently. When they wanted to change constitutional precedent, when they wanted to move this country left, they didn't go to the ballot box, because in the 20th century, at least until post-Vietnam, this was a very conservative, Judeo-Christian-founded country. They went to the courts and to very leftist Supreme Court justices and changed a lot of law in criminal procedure, in civil rights, in many areas. The environmentalist movement used lawfare to sue on behalf of this one-eyed, green-spotted turtle very successfully to halt enormous development across the country, to freeze up entire lands, privately owned lands, on the basis of an environmental threat to a lizard. And that sounds funny, but it's real. They understood the value of the courts. If you look today, for example, this process of lawfare is now on steroids. If you want to attack a political person or party or movement, what is the best way to do so? Is it to spend millions and millions and hundreds of millions, even billions of dollars at the electoral box, getting a president elected, getting congressional members elected? Or is it better to spend just hundreds of thousands or millions of dollars suing and getting your case heard by the Supreme Court or lower courts, or using prosecutors to take individuals to court to make your case? Again, not taking a political stand on President Trump, because it also took place, we used it with President Obama. But if you look at the legal procedures being used to change election results, they're being done in the courts, or now in the court of Congress through impeachment. The most effective way to make legal change in this country is through the courts, not through lobbying, not through crafting legislation. Because with the social media and the viral effect of wrong public narratives, you can win or lose just like that. If you go to the courts and you pick the right judges, you can win. Now, the left used this very successfully throughout. In the 1990s, after CARE had been founded by Hamas and other Muslim groups, they began to utilize the courts as well, realizing that the left had taught them something valuable, so that if you criticized one of their Islamist organizations, you researched and found that they were founded by Hamas, that they were being funded by terrorist organizations abroad, they would sue you. They would sue you in the United States, or sometimes even better, they would sue you in London, because there the laws for defamation are extremely lax, and you don't have nearly the protection you have under the First Amendment that you do here. They would get a judgment in a libel tourist jurisdiction like London. They would come running to the U.S. courts and get that judgment domesticated here, and there was no trial. There was no First Amendment. That's been changed by legislation. But in the 1990s and the first part of this century, CARE and other Muslim groups used that to stifle any kind of research that would make the connections between Muslim Brotherhood, Sharia, and terrorism. After 9/11, when the criticism and the dot connecting began to take place, and we started going after the Muslim Brotherhood groups and the connection to Sharia and terrorism. Organizations that I represented, Frank Gaffney Center for Security Policy, gun range owners, individuals like Pamela Geller, who were out with her website protesting Sharia and supporting Israel, were being sued right, left, and center by these organizations, and they were being supported by, whom else? The ACLU. Mm. And oftentimes, those ACLU lawyers were Jewish. We founded American Freedom Law Center in now 8 years ago. My colleague and I, Robert Muse, who's a devout Catholic in Ann Arbor, Michigan, 12 children, combat Marine officer, and probably the best First Amendment litigator in the country. In my view, not probably, he is. And we began litigating on behalf of these organizations and individuals who were being sued, and decided that it wasn't enough to simply be on the defensive. It wasn't enough simply to respond in court and get them out of the litigation. Our goal was to be on the offensive and to use lawfare exactly the way the left and the Muslim Brotherhood groups were using it. So what did we do? We told Pamela Geller, take your ads. I wish I could show you the PowerPoint. But she started in New York City. New York City. Let me repeat that. New York City. How many Jews live in New York City? How many Jews in New York City love Israel? And on her ad that she wanted to run on the Metropolitan buses was a saying that she stole from Ayn Rand, which was, in any civilized society, I'm going to pull it up, because I don't want to get it wrong. And I'll even try to show it to you. I don't know if you can see it. In any war between the civilized man and the savage, support the civilized man. That, of course, comes from Ayn Rand. Support Israel, defeat jihad. Now, does anyone in this room find that problematic in any way, shape, or form? Is it demeaning of any particular group? Well, the MTA, run by Jews. I repeat again, it's New York. Decided that that ad demeaned Palestinians and could not run under its non-disparagement provision. We sued the MTA in the Southern District of New York, and we asked in court, we had a full-blown trial, and I had the head of the MTA on the stand, and I asked him, what exactly is demeaning about that ad? In any war between the civilized man and the savage, support the civilized man. Clearly, that is fine. Support Israel. Nothing wrong with that. Defeat jihad. Jihad is war. War against the West. And his answer was, well, we consider this demeaning because what you're really saying is that the Palestinians who are engaged in jihad against Israel are savages. Now, in my closing argument, I asked the judge, who happened to be Jewish, Judge Engelmeyer, appointed by President Obama, a liberal, but a very smart one, I asked the judge, how is it possible that the MTA tells me that my client's ad is disparaging to Palestinians because they're acting like savages? If they are acting like savages, then it's not disparaging to them. They would, in fact, embrace the title. If they're not engaged in jihad, then they're not savages, and they're not the subject of this advertisement. The judge, a liberal, disagreed with me. He said the message is clearly disparaging of Palestinians, but, Mr. Yerushalmi and Mr. Muse, you win on the First Amendment. Because the First Amendment says the government cannot censor speech because it doesn't like its viewpoint. And it's viewpoint discrimination to say that you're allowed to run something that's not disparaging, but you can't run something that is disparaging. Now, by the way, the MTA ran ads continually, and this is why Pamela Geller wanted to run this ad, that attacked Israel as an apartheid war criminal state. No problem disparaging Israelis and Jews. But if you disparage Palestinians by implication, if they're acting like savages, that was impermissible. That case went to the Second Circuit Court of Appeals and was upheld.
Which one?
The MTA attempted to go to the Supreme Court and they rejected this writ of certiorari. And that stood as law in New York and now across the country. Pamela Geller ran ads like this with some coaching by us in every metro transit company across the country, and we have a string of wins, and the only time we lose is when the MTA said, okay, we're shutting down all speech on our buses and our trains and our subway stations. All you can do is sell goods and services. You can't talk about any kind of public issue. And that's legitimate. In fact, it was our position. Government transit authorities should not be in the business of advertising. Because that's the government. And if they are in that business, they have to behave like a government and respect the First Amendment. Well, guess who opposed us on all of these?
The ACLU.
The champions of First Amendment speech, as long as it attacks Jews and does not disparage Muslims. Yeah. And who were the attorneys we were fighting against at the ACLU? Litzar Reinu, unfortunately. That is one aspect of the new battlefield. I can give you many other examples. I'm going to give you one other key example that I think speaks to the broader problem of how Islam has used lawfare and the threat of violence to weaken Western society. My colleague Rob Muse had represented evangelical Christians at the Arab National Fair in Detroit, Michigan, that had been arrested for preaching and upsetting Muslims over the years, and mostly in the area of getting the criminal charges dismissed. When we formed AFLC, the American Freedom Law Center, and we're a national public interest law firm, so we represent our clients pro bono, there was a group of Christians who had gone to the fair to evangelicalize the Muslims that were there peacefully on public sidewalks, along with every other group that was out there. The Muslims that began to gather around and have a conversation, and it was all being videotaped, were peaceful. There was no violence. There was some heated words by some of the Muslim youth and some of the imams that had gathered. But until now, it was very peaceful because the leader of the Christian group, Acts 17, was a Muslim physician who had converted to Christianity. So he spoke their language, he understood their history and their culture, and it was an engaging conversation. One of the imams literally called for jihad. He used certain terms that under Islamic law require a violent reaction among the younger Sharia adherent Muslims there. There was a response and it got violent. The police moved in with mounted horses, with reams of police, and instead of protecting the peaceful speakers against the violent mob, they arrested the Christians. All of this on tape. We stepped in and won the criminal lawsuit in front of a jury, and then sued the city of Dearborn. It was actually Dearborn, Michigan, otherwise known as Dearbornistan. The end result of that litigation was a complete victory for the First Amendment, but to get there would require almost an incredulity. We went to the federal district court and argued that the police essentially adopted a heckler's veto. A heckler's veto under the First Amendment says that if you're speaking publicly and not advocating imminent violence, and someone responds to your speech violently, they can't impose a heckler's veto. The government cannot shut you down. It has to shut down the heckler. Otherwise, you give a heckler a veto. Now, we've all seen this on campuses across the United States, especially here in California and down here in this area of the world, where Israeli ambassadors and speakers come to college campuses. The Palestinian and Muslim groups come out in force and threaten violence, and the university shuts down the pro-Israel speaker on the grounds that we can't take the risk of violence. That's a heckler's veto, and it's impermissible by a government. The district court judge, and I want to read you his opinion, just the quote. We lost at the district court when we sued the city. And the court ruling was as follows. The court finds that the actual demonstration of violence here by the Muslims provided the requisite justification for defendant's intervention, this police department. Even if the officials acted as they did because of the effect of the speech had on the crowd. So in other words, if you're speaking in under the First Amendment and you happen to say something that someone else doesn't like and they act violently, you lose your First Amendment rights. This is a district court in the Sixth Circuit of the United States. We took it to the appellate level, the Sixth Circuit, and when you first appeal a district court opinion, you go to a three-judge panel. And we lost there 2-1 on the same basis. Happened to be an African-American, older African-American, who understood the First Amendment, wrote a beautiful dissenting opinion that said, I don't know why the district court got it wrong, and I'm flabbergasted that my two colleagues had got it wrong, but something's at work here other than the First Amendment. There's some underlying fear going on here. But this is the heckler's veto. Based upon that dissent, we then sought a special en banc review by the entire circuit, which is as rare in appellate courts and circuits as getting a case heard by the Supreme Court, 1 in 1,000. Well, the court took this case, reversed the panel, reversed the trial court, and found in favor of our clients. The city of Dearborn ended up paying hundreds of thousands of dollars to our clients. The next year, they canceled this Arab Muslim fair on the grounds that the insurance, the liability insurance, was too great that we would sue them again. When people say to you that Sharia is over there in the Muslim world and it's not a threat here, remember this case and other cases like it, where judges have been cowed to literally turn their backs on the First Amendment and long-time precedent. The heckler's veto is not something that we've just come up with. It's been the law of the United States for decades under First Amendment precedents. If you look at case law across the country, you will find state courts utilizing Sharia judgments as the basis for their decisions. I'll give you one final example, and I will tell you about a public policy initiative that we undertook at the American Freedom Law Center. Howard mentioned it. There are many cases like this, but there's one case that stands out. A Pakistani man and woman came from Pakistan, married, to the United States, lived in Maryland, where they had a child. The Pakistani man, over some time, decided he wanted a second wife. He was a Sunni, and he was allowed up to four wives according to Sharia. This Pakistani woman had become Americanized, some might say civilized, and said, "No, dear, you're not going to have a second wife, not while you're married to me." And he said, "Well, I'm going to go to Pakistan, and we'll see about that." So he went to Pakistan, and he took a second wife. And then he came back to the U.S., and his wife said, "Not in my house." He went back to Pakistan, and he went to the Sharia courts, which are government courts that have jurisdiction over aspects of criminal law, apostasy, blasphemy, marriage, divorce, custody, and he got a divorce. How did he get a divorce? Under Sharia law, he said three times, "I divorce you, I divorce you, I divorce you." Done. The woman has no such right under Sharia law. And then he called her to court over custody of his young child.
Oh my God.
In Sharia, unlike U.S. and Western law, unlike the treaty that we signed with most of the civilized world, custody does not go according to the best interest of the child. Well, I'm not being quite truthful. Islam says that after a child is done suckling, it is always in the best interest of the child to be with the father. Because the father, under Islam, brings the patrilineal lineage. A Muslim man can marry a non-Muslim woman. It's not a problem. He shouldn't, but it's not legally a problem. The children will always be Muslim. So when he went to the Sharia courts in Pakistan, he called his wife to attend. By this time, they had been living separate for several years. She was raising the child alone in Maryland. She had rejected Islam. In fact, was now involved with some other man, a non-Muslim. And she knew that had she gone to Pakistan to fight the custody battle over there, she would be subject to the apostasy laws and the death penalty. Pakistan has the death penalty for apostasy, and it's enforced by Shia courts. This is, by the way, a nuclear country. She didn't go. He got his judgment of divorce and custody. He came to the Maryland courts, and under our various legal doctrine, the courts gave it comity, meaning they recognized it and simply stamped it without any kind of trial or hearing. And it became the law of Maryland that she had to turn over her child to this man. She ran to the Maryland courts and said, "Whoa, whoa, 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 I want a divorce under Maryland law, and I want the custody issues decided by Maryland law. I'm a Maryland citizen. My child is now a Maryland citizen." That doesn't fly. The court said, "No, you had an opportunity to go to Pakistan and fight the battle there." And she said to the court, "No, if I had gone, I would have been subject to the death penalty." In the trial, at the trial court level, she brought an expert who testified that that would have been the case. The trial court said, "Under our law, we give foreign judgments comity as long as there's some semblance of fairness. And you had a chance to go there. And you chose not to." Or they said, "You know, you might have run to a court here first." That then went up on appeal. Thankfully, she had the means to appeal it. And what did the Maryland Appellate Court say? And now I'm almost quoting. We affirm the lower court's decision because even though the petitioner, the woman, has established that had she gone to Pakistan to fight the custody battle there, she would have been subject to apostasy laws and a possible death sentence, because, I'm glad you're all sitting down, because she didn't go, we'll never know.
That's Maryland.
Now, if you doubt, I published many articles. You can find them. Google my name. You'll find these articles up the wazoo where we brought that case. You could even find it through Google's legal search tool. Because of that case and many like it. Okay, so I wasn't truthful. I said I was going to end there. I'm going to add one other case. There was a New Jersey case. A woman was being beaten by her husband, sent to the hospital, facial fractures, black and blue. The hospital got her to go to a court. She was a Muslim woman, married to a Muslim man. Got her to go to court and get a restraining order. The judge refused to issue a restraining order on the grounds that the man didn't understand U.S. law. He was following Sharia. Now, the appellate court there reversed properly, but you can see it was only by happenstance that the court there reversed, and in Maryland it didn't. The woman lost custody of her child. The child is now being raised in some madrasa in Pakistan. He's now an adult. So no telling where he ended up. We drafted what was called the American Laws for American Courts. And it said something very simple. In any state court, if you wish to apply a foreign judgment or use of foreign laws in the state court, which is acceptable, if you and I enter into a contract and we both agree that the laws of Timbuktu will apply to our disputes, a U.S. court has to apply it. Unless those laws are so anathema. But we see that that's a very flexible doctrine. It's actually called the void is against public policy. But the courts don't know how to apply it. And this law says that if a foreign law or foreign judgment being applied in a state court violates a fundamental federal or state constitutional right, it is not to be followed. And you apply state law. That has become law in now 15 or 16 states. One of my most successful public policy endeavors, but I will tell you this. Many states have rejected it. And why have they rejected it? Because the ACLU will line up one speaker after another in the committees that have to hear it and pass it on to be voted upon to reject it. The American Bar Association has labeled me an Islamophobe as its author and has come out publicly with a public statement that it is bigoted, et cetera, et cetera. And then they have some legal language that they use, like it's not necessary because we have this doctrine of void is against public policy. It's redundant. It's this. It's that. None of those arguments make sense. I published many an essay on exactly why this law is necessary, but you can see it in action in Utah, in Missouri, where it's been passed. It's been used as precedent, as statutory precedent to throw out foreign judgments and the use of foreign laws that violate state and federal constitutional. And by the way, it says foreign laws. It doesn't say Sharia. So it's not simply targeting Sharia, although I've admitted publicly and testified before many state houses that if you want an example of the bad boy in this world, you can find it in Sharia. But it's not the only. In each of those instances, the ACLU was on the forefront of the objections. And what was their argument against a law that said that a foreign law and a foreign judgment that violated state or federal constitutional rights should not be applied? I'll leave it to you to go read their justifications. But silly or incoherent doesn't give it justice. At the end of the day, the courts and lawfare is where this battle is going to be won or lost. It's why if you're pro-Israel or conservative or Western in your outlook, you understood the importance of someone like President Trump. Forget all the other politics. In terms of the justices on the Supreme Court and in the state court levels, meaning the circuit courts and the district courts, not the state courts, but the federal courts operating across the country, how important that was. If we don't understand that battle space today, I guarantee you that we will have lost the battle. And I will only make a final plug for the American Freedom Law Center. We're a nonprofit organization. We have two senior counsel, myself and Robert Muse. We have paralegals and contract staff attorneys. We don't charge our clients when we represent them. And we've represented some very good and courageous people across the country in this battle. And we get our operating expenses from three areas. One, my private commercial law practice, which donates a substantial amount of money to the organization. Two, donors that understand the work we're doing and the importance of it. And three, legal fees that we win in winning in court and extracting our pound of flesh. We've been very successful in that last category, but it's not enough to support the work we do. So as you go forward, I invite you to go to the AmericanFreedomLawCenter.org website, AFLC.us, if you want to take a shortened version. All the work that we do is there. We're the only organization fighting this particular battle on a regular basis. We handle a lot of pro-life cases as well. As I mentioned, my colleagues are devout Catholic, and that's been an area that he's litigated. But you'll find that the free speech issues that apply to pro-life demonstrators are the same issues that apply to us as we criticize the Muslim Brotherhood organizations and Sharia. Thank you.
We're all enthralled by it. It's great. If you have some time to answer some questions.
Is it still the questions,
sure.
Maybe?
Yeah. Yes, sir.
When I go tomorrow and I meet a friend and I express what you just taught me tonight and he called me an Islamophobic person, what our answer to him?
Well, I'll tell you a little personal anecdote. First of all, my 23-year-old son, my eldest, just got engaged to be married. Thank you. But when he was young, not so young, but I guess he was a teenager, and even though he was a yeshiva bacher, and my daughter was also in yeshiva in Crown Heights, you know, in this day and age, they knew how to get to the internet. And when they first found Google, and realized they could type their Tati's name into Google and see what the world said about me, they came to me practically in tears. Oh. Abba, how is it possible? They say these things about you. Islamophobe is the least of my worries. All I can tell you is that this is a nasty battle space. Mm-hmm. I have been called a lot of bad names. If you Google me, you'll see a long list of what I am. I'm a bigot, I'm an Islamophobe, I'm a misogynist. I even hate Jews. You know, when they first saw my name, I guess they didn't understand that Yushami was a pretty Jewish name. And they saw that I had an office in Arizona, because I did not list in the early part of this battle space my office in Crown Heights for obviously security reasons. And they thought I came from Arizona. So they were certain that I was a neo-Nazi. And that's how I was characterized. Until finally the New York Times ran a full page above the fold Sunday edition on yours truly as the consigliere of the anti-Sharia movement and said, we're not going to tell you exactly where he lives, but he lives in Brooklyn somewhere. So then they put two and two together and I became the anti-Jewish Jew because I'd written articles, constructively I hope, critical of many Jews in the leftist world that attack Israel and this issue. I've been sued by Muslim Brother organizations. I've had bar complaints lodged, none of which have ever gone anywhere. But it is a very, very hard battle. And my commercial litigation practice, when I finally decided to do this full time and really make it with American Freedom Law Center, I understood was going to shrink because I was going to become radioactive. Thankfully, I have legacy clients that have supported that part of my practice. Mm-hmm. But there's no question that many of my former clients and colleagues at the big law firms that I used to litigate with say, David, we can't have you anywhere near us because you're just too radioactive. And it's not just me. Pamela Geller, if any of you know Pamela Geller, the author of these Metro ads and the owner of some very, very popular websites and Facebooks before the big social media types have tried to shut her down, she actually had a fatwa against her. Mm-hmm. And when holding a convention on the Muslim cartoon contest, came down to Texas from Phoenix, Arizona, to assassinate her. Thankfully, they were killed by security guards. She lived, and still does, with 24/7 security. Her condo building, a nice condo building in the Upper East Side, wanted to kick her out because the New York Police Department parks a car outside her building 24/7. Wow. She stopped making public appearances at all because of the threat on her life. So all of us in this battle space recognize how dangerous it is, professionally, personally. It's just something you live with. And it's why, another plug, a rather naked plug, the American Freedom Law Center is so valuable. Because none of the other conservative groups, none of the public interest law firms that were protecting Christians and their free speech rights, none of them were prepared to touch this area. Because the moment they did and got attacked so viciously and countersued, sanctions being sought against them, even though they could win those, it withers even the hardest and thickest-skinned lawyer around. Mm-hmm. Why go through that?
I have a question.
And the gentleman in the back. No, you're next.
So I wanted to ask you, because this term Islamophobia...
Can I ask you to come forward, because I'm very hard of hearing, and I won't be able to hear you.
This term, Islamophobia, basically, it's a bogus term. It's a pseudo-psychiatric term. And I don't understand why more people don't expose it for the hoax that it is. Have you looked at it from that perspective? It's like, you know, if I may add, it's like you take a horse and you glue on a horn from a rhinoceros, bingo, you have a unicorn.
It's a good
wonderful.
Point. It's a good point. When Islamophobia was first termed by the Muslim Brotherhood, termed successfully, it had been used in a few academic pieces, many of us in the public policy, national security arena would make the argument that it, as a term, is incoherent. If you want to say Islamic bigotry against Islam or whatever you wanted to say, but Islamophobia as a term is incoherent. Unfortunately, in the public policy arena, spin or argument doesn't always work. In fact, I would say that in this day and age, with social media and the way incredibly false narratives go viral as truth, the day and age of sitting in a room with public policy experts, and I've been doing it all my professional career, and then someone always stands up and says, you know what the problem is? We're just not getting our message out there. And you look at them and say, what are you talking about? We're spending millions and millions of dollars and man hours. The mainstream media repeats what it wants to repeat. And you can put full-page ads in the New York Times and the Wall Street Journal, but then it's fish-wrapping the next day, as we used to say. Spin and propaganda doesn't change the narrative in any real way. Those of you in the Zionist of America know that in the battle to support Israel, propaganda, what's the term we use in Hebrew?
Hasbarah.
Hasbarah. That was the calling card of supporting Israel. If we can just get the narrative right, we can change the narrative. And the truth is, look around you, folks. With all the billions spent, and that's a literal number, on Hasbarah, it hasn't moved the scale meaningfully at all. You have to have propaganda as part of your public policy agenda. But if you don't get that spark, we have been talking about Sharia and the Common Threat Doctrine from 2004 until 2009. Unsuccessfully, even among the national security conservative types who say, David, you can't mention Islamic law because it's too religious. That can't be the problem. We recognize your arguments and it is the problem, but we can't use that. Wow. Pamela Geller, without even knowing what Sharia law was at the time, said that she named that mosque they wanted to build on 9/11 territory, the 9/11 mosque, just named it that on her website. And somehow that caught. And then she said on her website that it's the Sharia 9/11 mosque. And then it took over. That became an entirely new narrative that even the mainstream media used in attacking her as being an Islamophobe. In other words, the very criticism of her developed a new narrative. Now, what really was the winning argument on Sharia? We were banging our heads against the wall. Pamela did some real good with her 9/11 mosque and literally changed the narrative in real ways, but we still weren't getting out there. What was it? It was turning on your TV or opening up your browser and watching Muslim after Muslim terrorists say, Allah Akbar, Sharia, the global caliphate, over and over and over again, so that finally when the George Bushes and the President Obamas and everyone else was saying, they've kidnapped Islam. And all you heard from Muslims abroad was this singular message about jihad, because the Muslims abroad were frightened to death to say anything against them. You had a few lone voices providing apologias in the United States. That's not real Islam. We're peaceful. There's no coercion. Jihad really doesn't mean what they say it means. It means an introspective, improving oneself. It's fighting the battle within. But what people heard from the Muslim world was only about Sharia and jihad. They made my argument better than anyone else did. And at the end of the day, today, I would dare say that most adults who aren't simply, as we say, drinking the Kool-Aid, know that Sharia is in fact the common threat doctrine of all Islamic terrorism. Let me go to someone else. Young lady?
Did you say you're fighting BDS in the courts as well?
We have been engaged now for 5 years in developing litigation, and we're very close, because BDS is an interesting phenomenon. There are anti-boycott laws in the United States.
No, but that's not what I'm driving at. I'm driving at the fact that the faculties, I happen to know about, because Tammy, I forget her last name, she is the soul of AMCHA. You may know about that?
Yeah.
Okay, so she has been fighting BDS for a long time. And I've told her, but she is tone deaf, that they're all hiding behind the First Amendment. These university deans and whoever is in charge of allowing or not allowing demonstrations on campus. And they're hiding behind, oh, it's a First Amendment right. No, the First Amendment is not without exception.
Okay, let me pause you, because I'm the lawyer here. You conceded that you were the chemist and not the lawyer. So let me just say this. The BDS, and that's why I say we've been working for now 5 years to develop the proper litigation strategy. But the reality is, under the First Amendment, thank goodness, you have the right to say all kinds of mean, hateful things.
That's not the point.
However,
it's inciting violence.
Just hold on. You're not allowed to defame. That's an exception. Mm-hmm. You're not allowed to commit perjury. You're going to court under oath. You're not allowed to just say what you want. It has to be truthful. You're not allowed to incite imminent violence. The standard under the famous case Brandenburg v. Ohio, a neo-Nazi case. That has been the law in this country for some time. Now, there's aspects that I disagree with, is that if I advocate, in theory, the violent overthrow of the U.S. government, that's protected First Amendment speech. I might not like that speech. Someone else might not like it. But because I'm not advocating the likely imminent violence, that's protected speech. So when a neo-Nazi was yelling in a crowd, Jews should be killed, and the African-Americans, using a different term, should be sent back to Africa, the court reversed his conviction for incitement and said there was no likely imminent violence arising from his speech there. Now, I will tell you that I've written some professional legal articles where I've criticized the imminence prong, which we would probably agree upon. In other words, I would agree with you that the BDS movement, you could make an argument that it incites violence. I don't know that that's a simple argument, but there's two prongs. Not only that your speech might, or the term is, likely incite violence, but it be imminent. And the courts have asked, what does imminent mean? Well, it doesn't even mean a month away. Does it mean a week away? A couple days?
Well, it means right away, but there's violence at these meetings sometimes. Right away.
But that's a different element. In other words, if I'm advocating the boy, and I don't want to get too much in the weeds in First Amendment law, but if I'm advocating boycott, divestiture, and sanction of Israel, I'm not advocating violence. There are people who might react to my speech violently, but remember the heckler's veto. The person speaking, even if it's something I don't like, the BDS speaker, is not advocating violence. The hecklers are getting involved in violence as a result. Incitement means I'm calling for violence, it's likely to occur, and it's imminent. Now, let me get to the Sharia question. Why does this not fit Sharia? Because we have cases, and the blind sheikh is one of them, and Andy McCarthy, the brilliant pundit today on National View and Fox News, who's on our advisory board at the American Freedom Law Center, and who convicted the blind sheikh of the first World Trade Center bombing, he will tell you that when the blind sheikh from in prison called for a fatwa for the overthrow of Mubarak and the attack on Western tourists, etc., in Egypt, there was no imminence. But you could bet your mortgage that there would be violence sometime down the road.
Absolutely.
The same way when Al-Qaeda issued a fatwa against Pamela Geller, it took months for two quote-unquote homegrown jihadists to drive down from Phoenix to Texas to try to kill her. So imminence in the Sharia world is probably outdated. Now, it's not part of the First Amendment proper. It's part of the court precedent. And I argued in my papers, as has Andy McCarthy, that that imminent prong needs another review. But the problem with going after BDS as the incitement side of things is that the BDS people don't actually incite, call for violence. Their listeners might engage in violence, but that's not what they're calling for. This also dovetails this question, because we mention it in the promos for this talk, the Southern Poverty Law Center, mm-hmm. which made its name fighting neo-Nazis easily. They were already bankrupt. And the founders of Southern Poverty Law Center got judgments and forced them into formal bankruptcy and developed an incredible mailing list to engender enormous donations mm-hmm. to the point where they have literally hundreds of millions of dollars parked overseas, a nonprofit organization. And they've come in the news because they were, the founders have been accused of all sorts of improprieties. They had to be fired or resigned. But the Southern Poverty Law Center has what they call a hate organization list, or a hate mm-hmm. map. Yours truly and the American Freedom Law Center are prominently exhibited there as one of the leaders of the haters in America.
Congratulations.
And I mean, we do wear it as a badge. My colleague was upset over the years that they kept mentioning me and not he. He's now been named. He's proud. So I'll get to you next. So the newly elected Attorney General of Michigan, a Jewish woman, one who's very pro-LGBTQRXT, whatever it is, and I just don't know the alphabet well enough to get that right. It's not considered a slight. Because she's part of that group of people. She came out publicly as so. And she and her civil rights department decided to use the Southern Poverty Center's hate list to develop a database to go after haters in Michigan. We're licensed to do business in Michigan. And at a press conference announcing this new database and initiative to go after, with the power of the Attorney General of Michigan, these organizations, she mentioned the American Freedom Law Center, front and center. Mistake. 2 days later, she was in federal court. It's still going on, but she's been backpedaling ever since. We didn't really mean to follow the Southern Poverty Law Center. It's not really a hate database, but that's part of the aspect of how the left aligns itself. By the way, the Southern Poverty Law Center mentions every single hate group on the right side of the spectrum. There's not a single one mentioned mm-hmm. on the Muslim side mm-hmm. or on the environmental side. If you go down the list, and Pamela Geller once did an ad, it's a cute story. The FBI published an ad, and they wanted to run it on the Seattle buses, in which they said, if you help in the capture and arrest of any of the 25 most wanted terrorists in the world, you can receive up to $50,000, $100,000, whatever the reward was, because we have a reward program. It's very successful in the Muslim world. If you want a guy to turn, you offer him $500,000, $1 million, and he'll turn over. Well, the pictures happened to all be Muslims because they were the leading global terrorists. So Pamela Geller copied the ad and put their faces on. And, of course, the Seattle MTA would not run that ad. And we sued, and we lost in the trial court, but we won in the Ninth Circuit. And it was reversed, and she was able to run the ad. But if you look in the global terrorists, among the top 25, 21 are Muslims. One is an African-American woman, part of the Black Liberation Party, that went down to Cuba and is hiding out. And the remainder are environmental leftist groups engaging in violent global terrorism. You don't see any of those lists anywhere on the Southern Poverty Law Center. It's just organizations like ours and, of course, your standard white Aryan groups because they want to link us together.
Yeah. How much will this battle be won or lost in the courts versus won or lost in the schools?
So the schools is another very ripe arena. Obviously, we have the college campuses. But even beyond there, and there I think the battle is going to be in the courts when we sue the state-run and funded campuses for discrimination against Jews and pro-Israel speakers, etc., and in favor of BDS speakers. The other battle, and we've talked about it, is in the high school, junior high, and elementary level. And the fact is that across the country, curricula is being manipulated by the Muslim Brotherhood to demean Judaism and Christianity and to inflate Islam and its importance, even to the point where the schools have the children engaging in various Muslim rituals, pronouncing the Shahada, which is the vow to become a Muslim, and the like. It's a very difficult legal arena because the courts, and I would argue properly, say, look, this is really a battle for the local school district. If you don't like your curricula, go to the school district, get your people elected, make your commotion, and change it there. The courts are not a very good location. Judges are not trained in education. We don't want to become schooled on Islamic history or Jewish history or any other history. That's not our job. Well, yes and no. I think that's the proper public policy, but there are instances, and we're looking at a case right now in Massachusetts in which we have the foothold of some very good state laws, and the curricula there is so radically pro-Israel and so demeaning of Christianity, not so much Judaism, but the people battling that are a handful of very courageous Jews and a local Jewish lawyer who've been attacked viciously by the leftist organizations there and by the Muslim Brotherhood. We're looking to come in and take over and fight that battle. We still have some work to do, some legwork. And there's also, we think if we can establish the right paradigm to attack it in courts there, we can translate that across the country. And I want to just go to Linda.
But did you say radically pro-Israel, or did you mean radically anti-Israel?
Radically, the group.
Yes.
The curricula is against Israel, but this is a group of pro-Israel Jews.
Oh, okay.
Linda?
No, that's what I was just
saying. Did I misspeak?
Yeah.
Oh, okay, I'm sorry. My apologies. Okay. It's getting late. In the back, and you're next.
I want to ask you, informed by your knowledge of Sharia law, why is it that the Muslims seem to hate Jews more than they do Christians, or direct their animosity? Is that Israel?
That is both enshrined in Islamic law as we mentioned, the end of days. That's a verse in the Sunnah which has legal significance. The tree yelling about the Jew behind him. And it's also about the history. Muhammad, before he made his Hajj and took over Mecca, was simply an itinerant preacher. And he lived around and among Jews. And if you look at the surah, the verses that were written in his name for that period of time, they're very peaceful, very tolerant-like, very Jewish-like. He was illiterate, according to their history. And so he lived and talked and learned a lot from the Jewish tribes in the Arabian Peninsula. Mm-hmm. There's no coincidence that they don't take interest on loans, that they don't eat pig, that they fast on Mondays and Thursdays. There's all sorts of connections. There's no coincidence that a fundamental principle of Sharia law is lex talionis, which you all know, not by its Latin, but by its English or Hebrew, ayin tachas ayin, shein tachas shein, an eye for an eye, a tooth for a tooth. The problem is when he heard that from the Jewish tribes and understood that's part of Jewish doctrine, he didn't have any clue of the Talmudic discussions that came as gloss on top of that. So in Jewish law, we understood right away that that's a matter of civil compensatory law. You don't actually take a person's eye out or pull his teeth out or chop his hand off. Muhammad didn't understand that. He understood it literally. And so that's why under Sharia criminal law, you steal, you lose an arm. You poke someone's eye out, you get your eye poked out. That's the law of Sharia. So we see this development where Muhammad lived among Jews, but then when he went to Mecca and then came back, now he came back with an army to Medina, and all of the surah in the Quran, the verses in the Quran that come from this period, are warlike, intolerant, and very un-Jewish. And under Sharia law, by the way, the Muslims, when they get on TV and they talk to us, they always mention the peace-like verses. But what they don't tell you, it's very much a part of Sharia law, the doctrine of abrogation. The doctrine of abrogation says the verses that came after the Hajj, after he came back with his military, after he became very violent and warlike, those abrogate anything to the contrary in the earlier verses. It's a very sophisticated concept because they talk about how it abrogates, etc. When he came back, he's known for having entered into a treaty with one of the largest Jewish tribes on the Arabian Peninsula. And a treaty, of course, can only be under Sharia a temporary thing. And then he sought about to slaughter them, which he did. And the animosity and the animus between he and the Jewish tribes in the region was built in. His death is told by Islam that in his last battle where he killed a Muslim, Jewish tribe, he took one of the Jewish women, one of the regal Jewish women, as his wife. Apparently she did not like the idea. And according to Islam's history of Muhammad's life, she poisoned him. So we Jews are told that we're the cause of the death of Yashka, and we're also the cause of the death of this Jewish woman of Muhammad. So if you want to understand where that hostility comes from, you see it. But keep in mind that those examples, that history and culture, is enough to drive a kind of primitive animosity, but not an institutional one. That comes from Islamic law, that you have a country of Jews living in the heart of Dar al-Islam. And that's an affront to Islam. And as long as any sovereignty any Jewish sovereignty is there. And it's why all of the hardcore Palestinians will tell you, we don't believe in a two-state solution.
Nope.
Right? They want a one-state solution.
For us.
We all know what that would look like. Yes, sir. And I'll call this the last one unless someone gets really excited.
Thanks very much for your work. I've actually done bodyguard work for Pam Geller and Zuki Jasserbo. My question for you is, it appears that in the United States now there's a growing number of no-go zones. Are these very similar to the no-go zones in France and England? And if so, what's being done legally about that?
So for everyone who may or may not know, no-go zones are where Muslims predominate, and it becomes dangerous for civilians and even police to go into these zones. And you have effective no-go zones. Some people have been criticizing for using that term on TV because they say, oh, there's no real, where's the boundary? You know, this doesn't really exist. They're not formal territories. They're places where you know you don't go. Right? Back in the 60s and 70s, maybe even in the 80s, I think so, you didn't go into Harlem with my color skin at night. It's insane. I have a home in Crown Heights. You don't walk 15 blocks one way at night by yourself.
No, you don't.
Unless you want serious trouble.
No, you don't.
So these are areas where Muslims predominate, and especially in Europe. They're in London, but they're also in Sweden. There's entire cities that have been so taken over by the Muslim population, the hardcore Sharia-based, that the Jewish populations in those cities have left. There are places in France where Jews are told, do not wear your yarmulkes in public. You will be subject to attack. In the United States, Dearborn, Michigan, was like that for the Christians. You couldn't go, and the police were afraid to step in to do anything other than to arrest the peaceful Christians. While the Muslim youth were throwing bottles and stones like an intifada. So you will always see that developing. There are neighborhoods in Brooklyn, and they tend to be near Orthodox Jewish neighborhoods, because if there's not enough halal food stores, devout Muslims will buy kosher meats because kosher meats satisfy their restrictions. And again, that's another example of the Jewish connection that Muslims have. They understood certain things about kashrut, but not much. So if you look at halal and the regulations, it's fairly primitive, and it's clearly based upon their understanding, at least Muhammad's, early on. But these are neighborhoods that are next to Jewish ones where you see women going with burqas. I don't mean the hijab, I mean top to bottom coverage. Those are places where if you were to walk in there looking like me, you'd literally be taking your life into your own hands. Because these are places where jihadist cells are born, manufactured, and nurtured. These are places in Brooklyn, the greatest conversion factory of Sharia adherent jihadists in this country, and in fact in Europe, but especially in this country, are the prisons. You take an African American felon and tell him and teach him that Christianity is not his real religion, it's the white man's religion. Islam is the religion of Africa, of the Maghreb, even of sub-Sahara Africa. And you give him a reason, a theological-based, righteous reason to hate Western civilization, the white man, etc., etc. And you now have yourself a dangerous felon who's now a Sharia-adherent Muslim. And this has been studied and written about. And notwithstanding that, the U.S. prison system still appoints Sharia-adherent Muslim chaplains to go into these mosques. So, and there are those places in Brooklyn, we had an undercover tape. We, in our Mapping Sharia study, the individual that was running our study was a former national security agent. He had been in the Air Force. He was sent into Iraq to look for the weapons of mass destruction behind enemy lines, speaks Arabic. He went in personally to a mosque on Atlantic Avenue in Brooklyn, which is right across from the new stadium there. I forgot the name of it, but where the Brooklyn Nets play and so forth. It's a brand new stadium where the Atlantic Mall is. And in that mosque, the imam, who's known as a violent jihadist, a converter from, as an African-American, he went to Saudi Arabia, converted, became an imam, world-famous imam, told his congregation, interestingly enough, put down your Uzis, this is on tape, put down your Uzis, get right with Islam, and then go back out. And obviously that was a call for violence. And the rhetoric against Israel and the Jews is ripe in his lectures. So there are no-go zones. They're not formal zones. They shift depending upon demographics. But they're another example of this ongoing problem. And if you ask the left or the media, do these exist, you will be laughed at. Notwithstanding the fact that if you look at France, when they start going on their burning the car rampages and the police stand down, it's real. Okay, Linda, last question.
Okay. This is sort of about Israel. The antifadas, do they understand, I mean, do most Jews, do you think, in Israel understand that this is a religious war? And do they admit that this antifada, you know, when that was going on before 9/11,
right,
and blood buses being blown up and pizzerias and all that, I then said, this isn't about anything. This is about Islam. This has to be what something in Islam is causing.
Right. It's interesting. Israel is actually a harder problem than the U.S. Yeah. I was once debriefing an assistant Secretary of the Treasury on international terrorism finance. I was with Frank Gaffney and others, and we were in a room of high-powered Treasury people, and the head of which was a Jewish fellow. And I was trying to explain why Sharia-compliant finance was dangerous. And that if he wanted to track financing of terrorism, that would be the place to begin. His response to me was, David, I get what you're saying. It makes sense. I'm not an expert, but it just can't be true. And that I can understand. That's the ostrich head in the sand syndrome.
Yes.
It's such a big problem,
yes,
I'm going to ignore it.
Denial of
that's
reality.
That's human nature. The Israeli problem is different. The Israeli problem is, and this I told you a little bit about when I was in a meeting with the Turkish army types and NGO types, and they told us we were all mistaken back in the 80s and 90s, that it was a religious problem. The Israelis, the Shin Bet people, the Mossad people, everybody, the military people that were in the room with us, all had the same reaction that I had, but even more visceral. That, no, no, this is about, we understand a war about land and sovereignty. We do not understand a war about religion, and even more so, and this was what really was driving their visceral response, Israel embraced at its founding its Arab-Israeli citizens, and it embraced along with that their religion, mm-hmm, which is why in Israel you have the secular courts, you have the Jewish courts, and you have the Islamic courts. Sharia is enshrined for domestic issues, marriage, divorce, custody, as Sharia for Muslims in Israel. It has the force of law. So when people tell me, well, this country has adopted Sharia, well, Israel adopted Sharia a long time ago for its Muslim citizenry. Now, Muslims like Jews can opt out and just go to the secular courts. But just like a Jew in Israel who would want to marry a non-Jew, for example, they have to go to Greece, right? I mean, or wherever they go. The same would be true of a Muslim. And when a government, even an Israeli government, empowers Sharia that way, it forces many Muslims who don't want anything to do with it to have to embrace it. And Israelis are not ready yet, to this day, to say it's Sharia. They're not ready yet to say Islam is the juridical religion as an institution, not is the religion in someone's heart. A Muslim can have all, you know, there are 1.6 billion Muslims in the world. Well, without Sharia as an institution, with universities and courts, etc., then you'd have 1.6 billion different forms of Islam. Every individual would have his own. Go to a campus, go to a Reform synagogue, no insult intended, but ask any of those Jews, what is Judaism to you? And you'll get as many different forms of Judaism as you ask people, because it's subjective, it's phenomenological, it's what it is I want it to be. Today I want it to be X, tomorrow I want it to be Y, because it doesn't have any institutional value. An Orthodox Jew who follows an institution of Orthodoxy does. If you go to a conservative rabbi or someone who's gotten his rabbinical degree or her rabbinical degree nowadays from a conservative university, it has institutional value to them. They can tell you univocally what conservative Judaism is. They have their rules, they have their procedures. The same is true to some extent with Reform, but less so. That's the difference between talking about an individual Muslim versus the institution of Islam as articulated through Sharia. Once you move from the individual and understand the threat's not from an individual Muslim, because even if he's a jihadist, that's one individual. You can deal with that. You can bomb him, you can shoot him, you can imprison him, you can do all sorts of things. It's when Islam articulates the threat, the existential threat, through the institutions of Sharia, that it becomes generational. It now has the driving force of conversion in prisons, on streets, in college campuses, where the Muslim Students Organization exists. Now it has a body politic that regulates itself. That, from a public policy, national security perspective, is what makes it dangerous. Thank you all very much. I promised the last speech.